We're now going to turn our election, though, to the reality that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Trump friend has cemented his grip on power. He was reelected, and following his victory, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo declined to say what Washington would do if the Israeli government tried to annex the West Bank. And he also declined to say whether the United States still supported a two-state solution. Well, here to tell us about the implications of all of this, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Middle East expert Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on U.S., Middle East, and war policy. Her most recent books, she has several, but her most recent ones include Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror and Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. Phyllis Bennis, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Okay, so Phyllis, I suppose in many ways this was not entirely unexpected, given all of the boosts that Netanyahu received in the lead up to the election. But tell us your thoughts on the election and what it might mean for Palestinians and for the entire region.
Well, I think that the election was actually far closer than has been the case in the past, where Netanyahu essentially swept into power. It was a very close election. He actually ran neck and neck with his main challenger. But the victory, as you described it, which is right, has to do with the kind of coalition, the right-wing coalition he's going to be able to put together. I think in terms of the most important aspect, which is what does this mean for Palestinian rights, for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, Israeli colonialism, it probably wasn't going to change anything on the ground. The competitor to Netanyahu, a former general named Benny Gantz, is someone who put himself forward. He postured as a, quote, centrist. The new party he created, called the Blue and White Party, was led by a trio of former generals who were saying, you know, we're the serious ones, we're the ones who are not as crazy right-wing as Netanyahu. And yet, Gantz's main campaign video was taken from aerial shots, presumably by helicopter, over Gaza, showing the absolute devastation of Gaza that was left after the Israeli assault of 2014 that had killed 2,200 people in Gaza, overwhelmingly civilians, 500 of them children. And the narration had General Gantz bragging about how many, quote, terrorists he killed and how he knocked Gaza back to the Stone Age. So the notion that these were somehow the centrists as opposed to the Netanyahu right wing was really a very false claim. What is true is that the right wing coalition that Netanyahu has led for the last 10 years has moved even further to the right. It was already a far-right coalition in which, as weird as it sounds to say, Netanyahu was almost the farthest left in his government. Not because he was any less right-wing, racist, anti-Palestinian, as he had always been, but because the political culture in Israel had moved so far to the right that his coalition was now made up of the right, the far-right, the extreme right, and now adding in the virtually fascist right, the explicitly fascist party that he welcomed to come back into the Knesset after years of being kept out because even by Israeli standards they were considered too racist and too violent. This was the so-called Jewish Power Party that was based on the old organization Jewish Defense League here in the United States, led by the assassinated mayor extremist Rabbi Meir Kahane, which had been prohibited from running candidates for the last 20 years. Netanyahu orchestrated their welcome back into legitimacy, but they didn't win enough votes to get into the Knesset. But the significance here that you referenced early on, Margaret, I think is very important, and that is the role of the U.S. in assisting in this election campaign. So the U.S. gave a number of critical gifts to Netanyahu that he was then able to brag about, to hold up as evidence of why he would be the best prime minister, because he's best buds with Donald Trump. And in fact, in the last one, he actually bragged about it on the eve of the election itself. So if we trace those, it starts early in the Trump administration, where Trump led the United States pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, something that the Israeli government and particularly Netanyahu himself had desperately wanted to avoid the reality that Iran was in fact abiding by the terms of the Iran nuclear deal. So the U.S. pulls out of the nuclear deal. Then Israel passes its new so-called nation state law that makes Israeli apartheid official and open as a matter of law, when they said that only Jews have the right of self-determination in the Israeli state, leaving out the 20% of Israeli citizens who are not Jewish but are Palestinian. The U.S. embraces that, another gift to Netanyahu. Then the big one, the Trump administration recognizes Jerusalem as the so-called united capital of Israel and moves the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in violation of international law, U.N. resolutions, and 5 or 6 decades of U.S. diplomatic history. Then you have the recognition of the occupation, the Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights as somehow being legitimate. That was just a couple of weeks ago. And at the last minute, just about 48 hours before the election, the U.S. announces new sanctions on Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. And in response to that, Netanyahu goes on Israeli national television and says, "Thank you, Mr. President, for," I forget his exact words, but he essentially said, "for giving me such a good answer to my request," making very clear when he said "my request" that whether it was true or not, he was claiming credit for that action by the United States. So all of this was seen in Israel as evidence that Netanyahu, and perhaps only Netanyahu, has this kind of tight relationship with the Trump administration, with Jared Kushner, with the U.S. ambassador, David Friedman, with the whole gang of them. And they can now count on a so-called deal of the century, what Trump and his minions have been talking about for 2 years now, on the Middle East, which will, as we know from both leaks of what it says and from their other actions, it will take Jerusalem off the table as a final status issue. It will take settlements off the table because the people negotiating it are longtime supporters of the settlement process. It's taken off the issue of refugees from the peace process because one of the other gifts to Israel was the U.S. decision to cut its entire aid budget for UNRWA, the U.N. agency that provides basic food and medical survival supplies to the Palestinian refugees. And in doing so, in that cut, the U.S. also announced that it no longer believed that the 5 million Palestinian refugees registered with the United Nations are in fact refugees at all, that in U.S. terms now, the only refugees are the few people, it's a few thousand people left who are all in their 80s and 90s, who were themselves the ones expelled in 1947 and 48, holding the keys to their homes as children. They're the only ones left alive, and that their descendants, who live in refugee camps to this day, are somehow in U.S. Credence no longer considered refugees. Mm. So all of the issues on which a theoretical peace agreement based on two states or on whatever basis was supposed to be founded are all off the agenda, so that whatever economic decision gets put forward as a so-called peace plan, it will probably look something like the maquiladora-style factories on the U.S.-Mexico border, somewhere on the Gaza-Sinai border, and that will be that. That will be the end of the so-called peace agreement, and there will be an announcement by the U.S. that the conflict is now over, and anyone challenging that reality, such as the Palestinians still living under military occupation, still living as second or third or fourth class citizens inside Israel, still living as stateless refugees, any of them who say, well, excuse me, but it's actually not over, will then be considered hopeless irredentists, maybe terrorists, and will be treated as such. So that's what this is really leading to.
Wow. Phyllis Bennis, thank you for breaking all of that down, because and when you talked about the maquiladoras, I'm also thinking of the economic zones in places like Haiti, where people are mercilessly exploited, and this is supposed to be some form of liberation. Well, we are going to continue looking at this in some more depth. There was also the threat about possibly taking over, incorporating the land of the West Bank. Netanyahu hinted at before the election. So we'll have you back when we have a bit more time and discuss this in more detail. But you gave us a very good breakdown, I'll have to say, about what happened and what it all might mean. Thank you, as usual, Phyllis Bennis.